Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human. From the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich.
The policies and decisions of the United States in Afghanistan and Iraq will have implications and impacts in the region, the world, and at home for the years to come. Here with me today to continue our discussion of those impacts and implications are
from Lindenwood University, Dr. Dale Walton, Professor of International Relations, Dr. Brian Arndt, Assistant Professor of International Relations, and Dr. Marcus Smith, Assistant Professor of History. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So, gentlemen, the question is, how do we get into this mess, both Iraq and Afghanistan? And it's worth noting that Afghanistan is the Bush administration's gateway to be able to intervene in Iraq.
Well, I think that that's a key question because you really do have to look at these two together and how they actually, in a sense, undermined each other. That with Afghanistan, the Bush administration made a decision before they had boots on the ground in any considerable number that they were going to do nation building. They announced that up front. I remember when it happened that there was such a subdued response. There was almost no media questioning about it. It just sort of passed. And of course, this was shortly after September 11th, so everything was focused on that, and there was this rage and desire for revenge. And so I remember just being amazed that this nation-building mission that struck me as being likely to go wrong for so many different reasons, although I never imagined how wrong it would go, that this just passed. It was an act of hubris. But you had people within the Bush administration who, as we were talking about off air a little before, who actually didn't want to do Afghanistan the way that it unfolded. Apparently, Rumsfeld himself didn't want to. He saw it as more of a distraction. He wanted to follow a strategy that I would call a great raid strategy, of going in, displacing the Taliban, assisting the Northern Alliance, finding bin Laden, and if you can't find him soon, turn that into a small special operator mission, and then move on. Now, where Rumsfeld was disastrously wrong was he then wanted U.S. power to be applied in Iraq or somewhere like that. And so that's the other side of the coin. In the end, the Bush administration, or the president himself, I do think you really have to put this at the feet of the president. He thought that the U.S. could do both of these missions successfully. He was wrong on both counts.
Now, isn't it ironic that the Bush administration would want to do nation building, considering that he had campaigned specifically saying that the United States military should not be doing nation building?
It was enormously ironic, yeah.
So is there politics involved in this as well? The Bush administration seems to be highly critical of the Clinton administration, its handling of Bosnia, and then its no-fly zone in Iraq. That is to say that they didn't really think that the Clinton administration was doing anything effective.
Oh, certainly for that group that are often called the neoconservatives. I don't particularly like that title. I think it obscures more than it clarifies. But people like Rumsfeld, Cheney, that, yes, they saw the Clinton administration as being weak and timorous and essentially believed, and I can understand why, that if they just applied the hammer more forcefully, it would work. And that was really not outside the general kind of Washington consensus at the time. Within the Clinton administration, forgotten now, but there was serious debate at one point about potentially invading either North Korea or Iraq at different points, that there were people within the Clinton administration really talking in those terms and thinking in those terms. In the case of North Korea, it was never really going to happen. But then, in the case of Iraq, it was at least plausible. That was the attitude that the U.S., and Marcus sort of talked about it earlier, I think very well, that the reliance on the military led to was the U.S. has the world's best hammer. So if you've got a problem, just use your hammer.
All the problems are nails.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that I think is interesting here is this question about going in, and with Iraq in particular, that one of the reasons why they didn't displace Saddam Hussein after the first Gulf War was George H.W. Bush asked the important question, who's going to replace him? And there was no viable solution, one that was definitely one that they could make work. So better the devil you know than the devil you don't know type of situation. Did any of that change after the first Gulf War?
I am often asked the question if I think that the Iraq war could have gone better than it did, or if it could have been successful had it been managed better. The second question is a lot harder. Could it have actually been successful? The first question is easy. It could have gone way better than it did. Aside from the question of whether or not the invasion was justified or unjustified, but could the Iraq project have been managed better? Absolutely. You could have decided not to disband the entire military, immediately putting Iraqis...
That was the day the war was definitively lost.
Yes, putting a bunch of Iraqis, armed Iraqis, out of work, and you could have not gone about on a policy of widespread debathification when membership in the Ba'ath Party was simply a prerequisite for any government bureaucracy job. It didn't guarantee any sort of ideological attachment to the Ba'ath Party or Saddam Hussein. So there are a lot of things that had a clear negative impact, that if you simply remove those, it's easy to believe it would have gone much better. Just how good it could have gone, now that's harder to say. Since we've talked about both Iraq and Afghanistan, I just want to make one statement, and that is that when we as Americans talk about these countries and our campaigns there, we rightly focus a lot on our country's involvement there, because our government is the one we should absolutely be questioning and criticizing and holding to account. So that is right and good. But we can sometimes fall into the trap, and I'm not suggesting we are in this room, but I'm saying this for the public's benefit, hopefully. And that is that we tend to, even as we criticize our own government, in the same breath also blame the countries we invaded, which I think can be a big mistake. I don't think that our failure in Afghanistan was because we made the mistake of invading and trying to nation build or state build in an ungovernable nation. And I don't think that the American project in Iraq was doomed to failure because, in the same token, because of any intrinsic inability of Iraqis toward democratic governance. I think that our failures were our own. And I think it's important for us to own that and to not pass off any of the responsibility onto countries that we feel should have responded to our policies in a certain way or should have taken to a particular type of system we tried to implement and they did not. That's not on them, that's on us.
I think we often make the mistake of talking about democratization. We'll use that as the idea. That what will happen is we say, okay, we're going to come and give you a constitution and now go by that. But constitutions are living documents and they come out of the people and they come out of the culture. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason why the German constitution after World War II has been successful is because it really looks like a German constitution. It looks like Germans wrote it. The same thing with the Japanese constitution. And those succeed because they, in the end, become organic to the people and they reflect those people. And I think that the point you've been making before, Marcus, and I think is really important, that if you want to argue that the failure of our democratization in Afghanistan, it's not because of the Afghanis as much as it's because we attempted to impose a system that wasn't organic to Afghanistan.
I would say in part, yes. I would also say in part, these kind of debates often focus around, as I've said before, we debate whether or not democracy will work in Afghanistan, for example. And I think that's a useful debate to have. Should we try to implement this or not? But I think the mistake that's too easy to make is then that if democracy doesn't work, again, whose fault is it? It's the Afghans' fault because they're not suited to democracy. Whereas rather, I think we should be honest with ourselves, even as Americans. Is democracy or freedom the most important thing to us, or is it security and stability? Because when we were attacked by terrorists on 9/11, we responded by acquiescing to and approving the Patriot Act, which took away some of our freedoms in the name of security. And I think we should be real careful about faulting people in other countries when they put security and stability and well-being above political freedom. So that is to say, when the Afghan government that we helped put in place is not delivering the goods, when it cannot provide basic security and basic goods that Afghans have come to expect, like education, expectation of being able to procure adequate food resources and things like that, we somehow expect them to say, but you have freedom, but we gave you democracy, so you're cool, right? Food can come later, security, we'll work on that, but you got to vote, right? As if that should matter more than everything else.
I think that's an excellent point. And I would also add to that that there is a tendency, and again, this is something that you've seen unfold in the post-Cold War era and beyond, that Western democracies came to become crusaders for a particular vision of liberal democracy. And that, if anything, has become more pronounced in recent years, that now to be a real democracy, you must fit in a very narrow ideological sort of window. And a great example is the fact that the EU is now having an argument over whether all EU members are democracies. So you're seeing that sort of narrowing of vision really played out in Afghanistan. I was amazed that when the Americans were on the way out, that at the embassy, I think this was in June, but I'm not certain, that they had a pride flag flying over the embassy in Kabul. Was that for the benefit of the LGBT people who were about to be in the thrall of the Taliban? I don't think so. I think that was an act of self-indulgence, and the kind of act of self-indulgence that, if anything, probably got people killed. So those sorts of things that Westerners do can have very negative impacts, and they're not willing to look at that reality when they go to other places and try to impose a particular political vision, a particular set of values. If the public won't accept it, then if anything, as in this example, you might have caused harm to the people you're purportedly helping.
Well, I think one of the things Americans misunderstand is we tend to think, oh, we created democracy with our Constitution. In reality, the American democracy is 1,000 years old. It developed over time. It didn't just pop out of nowhere. It comes out of a British system that developed from the feudal age into the creation of an idea of a parliament, then ultimately how extensive that parliament would govern, then how many people would participate, and over in time. And we are part of the end result of that. And that's what I'm talking about with the idea of organic, is that it takes decades, maybe centuries in cases, for democracy to actually find the foothold to create that thing that exists within that people, and they have to figure out what that means to them. And democracy can mean food security, fasting more important, and that makes perfect sense, or it could mean for some people to vote. It all depends, but each society is going to find where that is. When we talk about a teeter-totter on where the weight is, differs for every society.
And people tend not to care that much, most people, about abstract political ideas when they're hungry or they don't have power or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good question in terms of if we were to look at, let's say, Asia, and whether or not after the Second World War, the United States could have simply pulled out and had no further intervention. Would people in Asia have gotten what they want? Of course, you had to define what do people want. Marcus suggested, well, just plain old survival. After the Second World War, Asia was highly devastated. Some of the regimes had been overthrown, only to have Europeans return. So what do people want? Is the United States trying to tell people what they should have? That seems to have been the case in both Korea and Vietnam, in the sense that the United States said, you need to set up this constitutional democracy. It failed in both places. But on the other hand, was the communism that resulted in North Korea and North Vietnam what the Vietnamese people wanted too? I often think of the Vietnam War as the Vietnam people simply being victims and never really getting what they was looking for anyway. That they were taken advantage by corruption in the South, and in the North, Ho Chi Minh might have been a great historical figure, but he was more or less pushed aside for a Maoist Marxist dictatorship, which wanted to spread until it unified all of Vietnam. So did they get what they wanted? How do we interpret the result? But in the case of Korea, now we have a fully functioning democracy.
Don, I think all of this speaks to what you brought up, which is that functioning, working democracies take time to get established. And we continue to look at parts of the world where we can take the Arab Spring, for example. The Arab Spring was not what everyone hoped it would be, but what it is proof that, yes, Arabs do understand what freedom is, and yes, they do want it. They will stand up and demand it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that tomorrow they're going to have a functioning democratic system. It takes a lot of time for the structures for democratic systems to get set up, for people who haven't had a chance to engage in civil society to learn how to engage in civil society. And they have to be given the opportunity by the powers that be to have that sort of engagement. All of that takes time. And that's not unique to the Arab world or the non-Western world. The French Revolution, look no further. A sudden political change, a sudden opening of participation to vast portions of the population that didn't have it before invites chaos. It's not that unusual.
And I would take an even somewhat darker take on that, is that we're still talking about this in the paradigm that democracy is a progressive sort of development, that you can expect more democracy and more liberty 100 years from now than today. I'm not at all, frankly, confident that there will be more liberty worldwide 100 years from now. I could easily see a world that is full of democracies that are utterly sort of decayed, as well as non-democracies. But I could easily imagine, I mean, all you have to do is ask a lot of Australians now what they think of Australian democracy, and they would say this isn't a real democracy anymore. Whether they're right or wrong about that is a bigger question, but the fact that governments now increasingly don't even, I'm talking about Western governments here, don't even really feel that they have to respond to the popular will, that the popular will is a barrier, and it's just something you have to work around and crush if need be. And that sort of attitude seems to be gathering more and more steam, as frankly, you're seeing what I think is very serious democratic decay in most of the long established democracies.
I think to your point on popular will as well, I think the extent to which money and resources can be leveraged to shape popular will in the image someone wants it to be shaped is a problem that we need to start thinking way more seriously.
I would absolutely agree with that, because we now are seeing the development of a sort of entire suite of technologies that together allow a fineness of manipulation of the individual human mind that is simply, it's worlds beyond anything that a Stalin or a Hitler could do. In those cases, you had to cut people off from information and just force feed them propaganda. If you're using the newer tools as the Chinese Communist Party is developing and using perhaps very effectively, it seems to be, people don't know that they're being propagandized. Their worldview is reinforced, but reinforced in ways that subtly change its direction bit by bit until it's what you want it to be.
And I don't think this happens just by state actors in the case of China. I think in the United States, I think it's more non-state actors that are engaging in this manipulation of the public consciousness.
Absolutely. If I were to make a short list of things that I think personally would help U.S. democracy, very aggressively breaking up big tech would be near the top.
Well, I think the whole problem for Western democracies isn't the system itself. It's the non-governmental players within the system who are giving the feeling, rightly or wrongly, of the system being corrupt in their favor.
Does this mean that Western democracies are vulnerable to takeover by non-democracies?
I honestly, well, with the exception of very weak democracies or something like that, I wouldn't say so. I think personally, the bigger problem is just internal democratic decay, that you continue being a democracy, you continue having elections, and there is a degree of choice inherent in that, but that increasingly what voters do just doesn't matter. And I think that there are a lot of Americans who feel that, not unjustifiably right now, that if you look at recent elections, the choices they've had for president, you look at the last numerous decades of how the court system has essentially taken over a lot of functions that formerly belonged to the legislature and defining policy. And yeah, I don't really, frankly, see why the average American should feel empowered in their democracy.
If we need something to bring this full circle, I think everything you just said is very ironic, because in the reading that I've done on Afghanistan, the problem with Afghan democracy was that it relied so much on the symbols of democracy, like carrying out an election, and overlooked some of the more nitty-gritty what goes on in everyday life, like how do people interact with the government? Do they get to have a hand in selecting their local officials or even their school teachers? Or is all this coming down by fiat by the candidate who got elected in your national election?
And it's not surprising that the Americans were there to oversee and guide this process. I'm sure it all looked great on a PowerPoint slide deck.
Knowing that at some point this was going to have to end, and that it likely was not going to end particularly well, and we've probably known this for, depending on who you're talking to, 20 years, or some a little bit less, did we basically blow the process? Because the pictures from Kabul were ugly. I admittedly, unlike everyone else in the room, I'm old enough to remember what happened in 1975. And I don't necessarily think that this was uglier than 75. They were both, in my mind, amazingly ugly. But where Vietnam collapsed very quickly in that respect, even though we saw for 2 years what was going to happen. Here, we've known we were going to get out and something was going to go bad for much longer. So is part of the reason that things happened in Kabul the way they did, is that because we simply didn't do what we should have done
as far back as the Bush administration for preparing to get our friends out if things went bad?
Oh, absolutely. This was a complete bipartisan failure. And I also would say something that is still considered slightly taboo in American political discourse, but I think on the whole, the U.S. General Officer Corps is rotten. It's become highly careerist, and you have a literal selection process that selects out people who will resist terrible, costly adventures. And so I think that there's a problem that goes deeper than even the civilian side, where I think everybody can see the problems with the U.S. civilian side, given the difficulties in the country over the recent years. But I think that there is a problem at the top of the military.
Well, that's certainly not new to history.
No, it's not.
By any means, I mean, Napoleon had to replace all the old generals with the ones that he thought actually had talent. And it pretty much worked out.
So far, the only person who is notably that I've seen has lost their job within the military as a result of what happened in Afghanistan was some lieutenant colonel who complained about it.
Wow, what does that say about the American military post-Cold War, when you look at it from that standpoint?
Well, I think it says something that you can say about the wider American government, that if you rise high enough, there's no accountability.
Well, I think that one thing to keep in mind is when this whole series of adventures began, General Shinseki actually did express a great deal of reservations about Iraq, and you can see what that got him.
Yeah.
So even people who might want to go ahead, if they see themselves as wanting...
Well, but also remember that was, in a sense, a different generation of general. That now people who are generals today came up basically through the post-Cold War system. And I think you're getting people who think differently than people like Colin Powell, who was in Vietnam and saw the impact of how the generals fought Vietnam.
I do think it's important to note, however, that the military's job is to carry out the missions given it. So whereas I do think it's important, as you pointed out in the case of General Shinseki, that in the decision-making process, officers do voice their opinions on whether or not they think a mission is good, what they think needs to be considered. But once that order is given for that mission to be carried out, at that point, the military's job is to carry it out. The military isn't policymakers. It's the job of our politicians to send our military on the right missions and not send them on the wrong ones. And I also believe it's the job of American citizens to hold our government accountable to that. We spend a lot of time rightly praising the sacrifice that our military men and women make. I think one of the greatest ways we can honor that sacrifice is by making sure that if our government is going to ask them to go put their life at risk, that it is only for a mission that warrants that risk.
I agree with you completely. I'm thinking actually at the highest levels where policy and generalship meet, that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they are supposed to function as military advisors to the president. Instead, they function as reinforcers of whatever the White House wants to do.
So is that bad or good?
I think that's terrible.
So in the sense that we constantly change presidents and administrations?
Well, no, I mean in the sense that it's the job of the Joint Chiefs to look the president in the eye and say, this is a terrible idea.
But if the president still wants to do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, then you have two options. It's funny. Of all people, one of the more influential authors on this was a young H.R. McMaster, later national security advisor and, of course, involved in the Trump administration. When he was much younger in the 90s, wrote a book on the Joint Chiefs, particularly in relation to Vietnam, basically making the argument, and I think it's a very persuasive argument, that they should have all resigned en masse. And ironically, of course, given his later career, but I think that the principle, I believe, was correct. And at the time, you know, when the book came out in the 90s, that was very controversial within the military because the idea was very prevalent, and I think it still is, that sort of what Marcus was expressing, that your job is to carry out the mission, but I think that once you get to the highest levels, reinforcing the bad notions of civilian policymakers to me seems the opposite of performing your proper duty.
Well, that seems like a good place for us to end this one. So on that note, I'd like to thank my guests today, Dr. Dale Walton, Dr. Brian Arndt, and Dr. Marcus Smith. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And we'll be back soon.